Thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Holbrook. First on this week's program, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. A measles outbreak is inevitable in Arizona. Are we ready? The story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on May 6th. Janeth Ibarra didn't know what to do. She was a first-time mom at 22 years old, and now the Phoenix resident was responsible for protecting two twin boys from the harms of the world. New parents drink from a fire hose of child-rearing suggestions, mommy blogs and car seat reviews, feeding tutorials, and daycare ratings. But after her boys were born last year, Ibarra was especially tortured about one big decision: whether to vaccinate her babies. The world is awash in vaccine misinformation, and it's no wonder if new parents like Ibarra have a hard time discerning which way is up. The anti-vax trend started in 1998, when The Lancet published a widely debunked study linking childhood vaccines to autism. The publication retracted it, though anti-vax proponents often fail to mention that, and went into overdrive during the COVID-19 pandemic. Once consigned to the fringes of society, the anti-vax movement is now depressingly mainstream. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., perhaps the single biggest purveyor of vaccine misinformation on the planet, runs the Department of Health and Human Services. Under his leadership, the department has axed crucial funding that helps state and local governments promote vaccine awareness and respond to outbreaks of disease. At the same time, the country is suffering through its biggest measles outbreak in decades. The super contagious disease, once considered eradicated by, you guessed it, vaccines, has popped up in 29 states as of May 2nd. At least 935 measles cases have been reported nationally since January. The disease, which is especially deadly to young children, has already killed 3 people, including 2 young children. They were the first measles deaths in the U.S. since 2015. So far, Arizona has been spared a measles case. But Arizona's vaccination rate is low. When it comes to measles, a vaccination rate of 95% is considered enough to ensure herd immunity, giving the disease nowhere to spread. But in Arizona, only 89.3% of kindergartners have received both doses of the vaccine against measles, mumps, and rubella. In some communities, the rate is far lower. It's in the middle of a cyclone of conflicting information. Are vaccines lifesavers, mortal threats? That Ibarra found herself in her pediatrician's office. She had begun to reconsider some vaccines, she said, and needed help plotting a course through the fog. Pediatricians are veterans of these talks. Ibarra says hers patiently told her the facts of things and promised to inform me of the correct things instead of what I see on the internet. Ibarra decided to vaccinate her kids. Though her 10-month-old boys are too young for the first dose of the MMR vaccine, the first dose comes at 1 year, the second at 4, she'll get them vaxxed against measles when the time comes. Vaccines are important, Ibarra said. They are very important to me, especially for my kids to have. Until then, though, her children are vulnerable. One of the fictions of the vaccines are a personal choice movement is that when it comes to diseases like measles, they're really not. Measles kill the youngest among us, and those very same young cannot be fully immunized until they're on the cusp of grade school. When a community has herd immunity and measles cannot spread, those children face little danger. when a community dips below that, as Arizona has, measles can attack the kids of even the most pro-vax parents. For the next 2 months, until her kids can receive the first dose of the MMR vaccine, Ibarra will be on guard. Though Arizona hasn't had a case yet, measles is surely coming. State and county public health departments have been bracing for it, but they have a hand tied behind their backs. In Gaines County, Texas, where the outbreak began, leading to at least 390 cases in the county, the MMR vaccine rate is 82%. In some corners of Arizona, the vaccine rate is lower. And RFK Jr.'s department just slashed funds for vaccine campaigns and epidemic preparedness. An outbreak will happen, said Dr. Clarissa Smith, a pediatrician in Yavapai County. I think that's inevitable. Is Arizona ready? A powder keg. Long before it was controversial, the MMR vaccine was tantamount to a miracle. Until it was developed in the late 1960s, measles outbreaks were a fact of life in the United States. Measles is one of the most contagious diseases on Earth. One person infected with COVID-19 can spread it to roughly 3 susceptible people. Someone with measles can infect up to 10, a difference with geometric consequences for the potential spread. For some, the disease is mild, a rash, a fever, a cough, and a runny nose. But according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 20% of unvaccinated people will end up in the hospital. Many of those will get pneumonia, and some will die. A serious measles case is a grim thing to see. If a child contracts measles, especially an unvaccinated child, they are increasingly susceptible to life-threatening complications. Kids who start with a nasty rash and cough can quickly find themselves gasping for air and being hooked up to a ventilator. Skin becomes pale. Due to a lack of oxygen, lips and fingertips turn bluish-gray. Some children will recover, but others won't. Instead, their parents will sit beside their hospital beds, holding their child's small hand as they slip in and out of consciousness. Maybe that beloved son or daughter will stay awake long enough to hear a last goodbye. In the end, the child's muscles give in. Their chest fails. It does not rise again. In 1962, before the measles vaccine was licensed, there were 500,000 measles cases in the United States. Roughly 400 to 500 people died each year, about 1,000 suffered brain swelling, and 48,000 required hospitalization. In 1990, when a second measles vaccine dose was recommended, there were fewer than 100,000 cases in the country. By the year 2000, the disease was considered eliminated. But who doesn't love a comeback story? This millennium, measles cases have become more common. There were 667 cases in 2014 and 1,274 cases in 2019. This year, the country is on pace for roughly 2,800 cases, which would be the most since 1992. For generations of kids, measles presented no threat. Now, it's on the hunt again. The biggest reason for that is maddeningly simple. More and more parents decided not to give their kids the shots that confer 97% protection against one of the most contagious diseases in the world. Arizona is among the laggards. According to the Arizona Department of Health Services, only 89.3% of Arizona kindergartners were fully vaccinated against measles during the 2023-24 school year, less than required for herd immunity, but not terrible. However, some areas of the state are more protected than others. Only 2 Arizona counties, Yuma and Santa Cruz, reached herd immunity, with Central County, Pinal, falling just short at 94%. In Yavapai and Mojave counties, herd immunity is basically a fantasy. Only 79.4% of kindergartners are vaccinated against measles in Mojave County. Yavapai County is a state worst 77.9%. You've got this whole giant cohort in these parts of the state where we have really susceptible kids, said Will Humble, the executive director of the nonprofit Arizona Public Health Association. In other words, parts of the state are a powder keg. If it does happen in our community, I anticipate a fairly large outbreak, said Smith, who owns Yavapai Pediatrics. It'll be a lot like that county in Texas. If parents would get their kids vaxxed, none of this would be a concern. But as Smith knows, the anti-vax current is strong. Every day at her practice in Prescott Valley, she talks to new parents about vaccines. She reassures and presents the facts. There's a good portion of parents that just want more information, she said. Another cohort cannot be convinced. Those parents are very adamant that I'm not comfortable with it, Smith said. Because she requires all her patients to be vaccinated, those parents will have to find another pediatrician. Why are vaccine rates so low? There's the epidemic of misinformation. The bunk science RFK Jr. promotes is nearly as contagious as measles. But there's also the fact that generations of kids have grown up without having to worry about measles at all. Because many parents haven't seen the firsthand effects of a measles outbreak, they tend to underestimate how deadly one could be. It seems like we think that things happen to other people and not to us, said Dr. Kathy Krieg, a pediatrician based in Gilbert. We have this magical thinking that because we haven't died of this before, therefore, if it hasn't personally happened to us, it's not going to happen to us. People don't always do what's best for them, which is why your mom made you eat your vegetables. But in Arizona and many other states, no authority figure is lording over the table to say, no dessert until you vaccinate your child. Especially since the COVID-19 pandemic, when many conservatives rebelled against mask mandates and vaccine requirements, flying the banner of personal choice has been an avenue to political power. Lawmakers in Arizona and beyond have one office spouting conspiracy theories about COVID-19 and about vaccines at large. Governor Katie Hobbs, a Democrat, has already vetoed 4 anti-vax bills this year. Last month, when RFK Jr. visited the Arizona legislature to promote a healthy food bill, reporters were cut off and booed when they audaciously asked him, the man in charge of the nation's healthcare infrastructure, about the country's largest measles outbreak in decades. People who aren't vaccinating their kids aren't just doing that and being quiet about it, said Ashley Chambers, the executive director of Arizona Families for Vaccines. They're trying to convince other people not to vaccinate their kids. And they're trying to influence our lawmakers to enact policy that supports anti-vaccine people and their opinions. As a result, Arizona has lax vaccine laws. Many states require up-to-date vaccines to attend public school, insisting upon medical documentation and granting exemptions only for religious reasons. But in Arizona, all that stands between a parent and sending their unvaccinated child to school is a 2-page form. ARS 15873 allows parents to submit a signed statement to a school administrator outlining that, due to personal beliefs, they do not consent to the immunization of the pupil. It's as simple as checking a few boxes. When it's that easy to get out of vaccinating your kids, low-information parents or those who aren't already pro-vaccine are all the more likely to let it fall by the wayside. You get a lot of parents who say that they don't want their children to be vaccinated because it's easy, said Kelly Murphy, a coordinator at the Arizona Early Childhood Alliance. If you don't make it easy for people to opt out, then they won't. Though Arizona's exemption has existed for decades, long before COVID-19 hit, exemptions have skyrocketed since then, according to Axios. Last year, 8.5% of kindergartners had vaccine exemptions, which Chambers said leaves the state absolutely ripe for a measles outbreak. What's more, vaccination rates tend to follow a pattern depending on the type of school. If an unvaccinated student in a Maricopa County public school classroom catches a case of measles, there's a pretty good chance that every other kid in that homeroom, at least, is vaccinated, and it's not going to spin out of control, Humble said. However, the vaccine exemption rate in Arizona's charter schools is 6.6%, nearly double the rate at public schools. At private schools, it's 10.7%, nearly triple. If there's a measles outbreak, don't be surprised if it starts at a private school. It's much easier to get a cascade of cases at a charter or private school, said Humble, than it is at a public. When an outbreak happens. Measles hasn't been a stranger to Arizona in recent years, but it's no snowbird, buckling down for an extended stay. It has popped in briefly, then disappeared. In 2024, Maricopa County had 2 cases, and Yavapai County had 1. In September 2022, 3 related measles cases were confirmed in unvaccinated people in Maricopa County, and 1 person required hospitalization. A 1-year-old was also diagnosed with measles in Pima County in 2019. The next outbreak may not be so contained, but health officials have had plenty of practice. Nicole Witt, the Assistant Director of Preparedness for the Arizona Department of Health Services, said Arizona prepares for a measles outbreak every day. When a measles case pops up, here's what happens. If a child comes into a hospital's emergency room or physician's office with a rash, fever, or measles-like symptoms, doctors and hospital staff immediately isolate the patient and contact their county's health department. Next, an on-call epidemiologist with the county asks a series of questions about symptoms and testing. The county health department facilitates testing through the state, reaching an ADHS epidemiologist via an online form. A courier picks up a sample, generally a urine sample or nose swab, and drives it to an ADHS lab in Phoenix for testing. Depending on travel time, results are back in 4 to 8 hours. Since the Texas outbreak started, Maricopa County's public health department decreased the index of suspicion for measles cases, meaning they're testing more suspected cases than they would otherwise. Dr. Nick Staub, the chief medical officer for the Maricopa County Department of Public Health, said the department is testing 10 to 20 cases per week. None has come back positive yet. In the meantime, county health departments began to mobilize their incident command teams, which Witt called the boots on the ground. ADHS provides resources and support, but counties run the show. For larger counties like Pima and Maricopa, a team works to treat infected people and contain further spread. In Pima, emergency planners trained to respond to disasters coordinate with a 15-person public health team that includes epidemiologists and clinicians. Staff from other departments are reassigned to bolster the department's response. It's not one person on the phone trying to figure out if there was a positive case. We have a system on standby to be activated, said Dr. Andrew Saul, the assistant medical director at the Pima County Health Department. It's all hands on deck. That's how serious measles is. Epidemiologists launch an investigation to trace the infected person's whereabouts over the previous 4 days and determine who else might have been exposed. Clinicians administer MMR vaccines to exposed people within 72 hours of their exposure, which can help prevent serious health effects. People in high-risk groups, such as infants, pregnant women, and immunocompromised people, may receive immune globulin within 6 days of their exposure. County health departments also issue public service announcements in the form of physical posters, community events, and online posts. These advertise the communicable disease hotline, which residents can call if they come across a suspected case. It also tells them where they can get vaccinated in the county and what families can do to protect themselves. Smaller counties like Gila County rely more on community partners, such as nurses, school administrators, hospitals, and community health centers. Their resources are fewer. But both large and small county health departments have been prepped not only by past measles cases, but also by having recently battled, you know, the worst pandemic in 100 years. COVID really prepared us, to be honest with you, said Savannah Barajas, an epidemiologist at the Gila County Health Department. The West Texas outbreak has accelerated those preparations. Since that explosion of cases, Pima County's team has met every Friday for a month to get ready for a measles outbreak in their backyard. They've also been ramping up communication with community partners and updating messaging. Gila County has also been running tabletop exercises to prepare while also upping vaccine communication with residents. In one sense, the Texas outbreak is doing half the work for them. Since the outbreaks have been publicized, we are getting more people coming in to get vaccines, Barajas said. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as the saying goes, and the measles vaccine is mighty preventative. Vaccines are highly, highly effective for this particular condition, Saul said. No one should ever lose their child to a condition that is fully preventable. While health officials feel prepared, they're arguably not as prepared as they were 6 months ago. In late March, the federal government cut nearly $240 million of Arizona's public health funding, cutting into grants for epidemiology and vaccines for children that were funneled to all 15 county health departments. Mojave County eliminated the positions of two health investigators and one communicable disease investigator, both of whom would help the county contain an outbreak. Two public health nurse positions were eliminated in Yavapai County. Maricopa County had to scale back its mobile clinics, which helped to provide vaccines to uninsured people, those with disabilities, and folks who live in rural areas. The upshot is this. Arizona has fewer resources to get kids vaccinated against measles and fewer resources to contain an outbreak if one occurs, especially in rural areas. County health officials who spoke to Phoenix New Times for this story all expressed their confidence in their ability to respond to a measles outbreak, but it will also require doing the same job with less money. Any time that budget cuts result in our loss of staff, that does affect our ability to respond, Staub said. Our responses are very dependent on people, so when we lose those people, it does impact us. So, how ready is Arizona for a measles outbreak? Perhaps both readier than you might assume, especially given statewide vaccination rates, and not as ready as anyone who believes in vaccines would prefer. Some areas of the state and the valley are at particular risk. For the next 2 months, Ibarra will wait on eggshells until her boys can receive their first dose of the measles vaccine. Had they been born 20 years earlier, when measles were down for the count, there'd be little to worry about. That's not the world we live in anymore. They're so vulnerable, she said. And in Arizona, measles could strike at any second. Not so fast. Federal judge saves Oak Flat from mining company for now. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeru and was posted on May 9th. A huge mining company has to keep its hands off the holy Apache land of Oak Flat for now. On Friday afternoon, a federal judge ruled that the decade-long battle over the federally owned land, roughly 70 miles east of Phoenix, and its 40 billion pounds of copper, will be for the Supreme Court to decide. That hits the brakes on a planned transfer of the land to Resolution Copper, a company owned by British Australian mining megacorporations Rio Tinto and BHP. Environmentalists and indigenous groups have fought for years to protect the land from extractive interests, which would turn it into a crater. An ongoing freedom of religion lawsuit over Oak Flat sits at the doorstep of the Supreme Court, which has yet to say whether it will take up the case. However, the Trump administration recently announced plans to speed up the land transfer and potentially open Oak Flat to mining before the High Court could weigh in. Apache Stronghold, the group leading the charge against the land transfer, filed an emergency motion to stop the government from barreling ahead. Friday, federal judge Stephen P. Logan was convinced, issuing an injunction, to pause the swap, and the publication of an environmental review that would precede it, until the Supreme Court either declines the case or decides its merits. Even in the short term, Apache Stronghold has established a likelihood of irreparable harm should the transfer proceed, Logan wrote, adding that the group presented serious questions on the merits that warrant the Supreme Court's careful scrutiny. Logan also noted that if the land transfer wasn't halted, it could result in the permanent loss of Apache's legal rights to access their ancestral sacred site. It's unclear if the federal government will appeal. Apache Stronghold and its lawyers at Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty celebrated Logan's decision in a press release. We are grateful that the judge stopped this land grab in its tracks so that the Supreme Court has time to protect Oak Flat from destruction, said Dr. Wenzler Nosey Sr., Apache Stronghold's leader and former chairman of the San Carlos Apache tribe. The federal government and Resolution Copper have put Oak Flat on death row. They are racing to destroy our spiritual lifeblood and erase our religious traditions forever. Luke Goodrich, vice president and senior counsel at Beckett, said in a statement that the feds have absolutely no reason to ram through the transfer of Oak Flat while our case is standing on the doorstep of the Supreme Court. This ruling ensures that Oak Flat remains protected as the legal process continues, giving the Supreme Court time to decide if cherished Apache rituals can continue for future generations. A history of the Oak Flat case. The Apache's holiest place of worship, Oak Flat, sits nestled in the mountains east of Phoenix. To the Apaches, it is Mecca, though they note that it was created by God and not men. However, the Apaches don't own it. It's technically the property of the U.S. government. The government promised to safeguard the land for the Apaches, but broke that deal in 2014 when Congress approved a backroom land swap, brokered by Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake, that transferred about 2,400 acres of Oak Flat land to Rio Tinto in exchange for 5,400 acres in the state owned by the company. In 2021, opponents of the land swap, including Apache Stronghold, sued to block it. Two federal appeals court panels ruled the government could move forward with the swap, though five appeals court judges dissented, saying that the court tragically erred by refusing to protect Oak Flat. Apache Stronghold petitioned the Supreme Court to take up the case, which the High Court is now considering. But on April 17th, the U.S. Forest Service announced that in as little as 2 months, it would issue an environmental impact statement on the sale, a major step toward transferring the land. That led to Apache Stronghold's emergency motion in Logan's court, which hosted a hearing Wednesday. Ahead of the hearing, a group of roughly two dozen Oak Flat supporters ran over 3 days, from the holy site to the Sandra Day O'Connor U.S. Courthouse in Phoenix to raise awareness. They piled into a courtroom to hear Goodrich's arguments for halting the land swap and demonstrated outside the courthouse before and after the hearing. At the hearing's end, Logan said that he would rule by May 14th, 1 week later. Goodrich must have been convincing. Ultimately, the judge needed just a couple of days. Remember that if you missed any of the stories in this program or any other Sun Sounds program, you can listen to them on demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, click on Demand Podcasts, scroll down to the program you're interested in, and click on Listen. The program continues now with this story written by Morgan Fisher, posted on May 9th. GOP Feud. Party Chair may sue recorder over illegal mail voting plan. Last year, far-right Republican Justin Heap won the election as Maricopa County Recorder by harping on election integrity. He called Arizona's elections a laughingstock and flirted with the election denialism that has consumed his party. When he was in charge, he said, he'd secure the county's untrustworthy elections and follow the letter of the law. How's that been going? Not great. 4 months into Heap's tenure, he's caused a widening rift with a host of fellow Republicans in the Valley, feuding with the GOP-controlled County Board of Supervisors and the county attorney. Now, even the chair of the Arizona Republican Party is on Heap's ass and threatening to sue him. At issue is a plan floated by Heap earlier this week to mail ballots in an upcoming special primary election to voters who have not requested them. While Heap has cast this as an effort to make voting easier, the affected voters live far from polling places, he said, his plan carries the downside of being, well, illegal. Arizona law prohibits mailing ballots to voters who are not on the active early voting list or who have not requested a mail ballot in advance. In response, other Republican county officials have dunked on him. On social media, County Board Chair Thomas Galvin called Heap's plan appallingly bad and bizarrely proposed, adding that the board won't let Justin Heap set a bad precedent of bad election ideas. Fellow County Supervisor Debbie Lesko, hardly anti-MAGA, given that she voted against certifying the 2020 election while in Congress and has been public about voting for Heap, told a defense of Heap on X that the board stopped you from implementing an illegal plan. But perhaps the strongest comments have come from State GOP Chair Gina Swoboda, who told Phoenix New Times that the Arizona Republican Party will sue if Heap attempts to mail ballots to voters who haven't requested them. People who have not requested a mail ballot should not be sent a mail ballot because it adds to confusion and it undermines the integrity and security of the process. That's always been the position of the Republican Party of Arizona, Swoboda said. I'm astounded that someone who ran on election integrity can think that's a good idea. Heap's chief of staff, Sam Stone, did not return a request for comment from New Times, including about Swoboda's threat of litigation. But Swoboda's not wrong about Heap's election integrity bent. Heap concerned trolled about mail-in voting as a state legislator, voting for bills aimed at eliminating early and mail-in voting altogether. During his campaign for recorder, he called in-person voting clearly the most secure way to vote in an interview with Arizona's family. Now, he's not only promoting a plan to mail ballots, but promoting one that would break the law. If we're going to just mail people a ballot based on their distance from the nearest voting location, everyone in Apache County should get a mail ballot, Swoboda said. If you're sending a ballot to someone who didn't want it, doesn't know it's coming, and didn't ask for it, that's dangerous. Heap's feud with other county officials in his party, has been percolating for months. He fired the opening salvo by accusing the previous recorder and Board of Supervisors of sandbagging him by signing an agreement that stripped some authority from his office. Yet, the claims he's made about that lost authority haven't held up to scrutiny. Despite that, the Board of Supervisors has endeavored to strike a new agreement with HEAP to define the relationship between the two entities, particularly when it comes to election administration. Several weeks ago, the supervisors sent HEAP a proposed agreement that was the result of negotiations with his office. After HEAP accused the county supervisors of playing, quote, childish games to score cheap political points Wednesday night, Galvin reminded him that the board is still waiting for HEAP to respond to its proposal. BTW, we sent you a draft operating agreement on April 12th and still haven't heard back, Galvin said. The board also voted to send a letter to HEAP on April 24th, following up on their proposal. A brewing feud. Amid that backdrop, HEAP's suggestion to mail unsolicited ballots caught county supervisors off guard. The election in question is the July primary for the seat left empty by the late Democratic Representative Raul Grijalva, who died in office on March 13th. Grijalva's 7th congressional district mostly spans southern Arizona, but 57,000 voters in Maricopa County fall within it. A chunk of them live far from polling places. At a Monday meeting, HEAP laid out a plan to mail those voters ballots, whether they requested them or not. The supervisors were immediately alarmed. Galvin, Lesko, and Kate Brophy McGee, all Republicans, respectively called the plan something they were totally uncomfortable with, a slippery slope, and very bad precedent. The board, absent one member, voted unanimously to remove that proposal from the county's primary election plan. On Tuesday, after Stone claimed the Maricopa County Attorney's Office had vouched for the plan's legality, County Attorney Rachel Mitchell sent HEAP a letter basically calling him and Stone liars. In the letter, Mitchell wrote that not only had no one from the recorder's office requested advice from any attorney from my office on this topic, but that the plan was clearly unlawful. Mitchell went on to spell out why HEAP should have known that. One of his predecessors in the office, Democrat Adrian Fontes, now the Arizona Secretary of State, had been dinged by the courts for trying to do the same thing in 2020. Afterward, the Arizona legislature passed a law that makes it a Class 5 felony for a county recorder, city or town clerk, or other election official to deliver or mail an early ballot to a person who has not requested an early ballot for that election. That would seem to clear things up, right? Wrong. Wednesday night, HEAP posted a long missive to X defending his plan. He said the board's objection to his proposal was an attempt to gaslight the public, and attached an image of an email from an election staffer who argued his plan was legal. That email noted that in several elections, including the 2008 primary, 2016 general, and 2018 general, former recorder Helen Purcell automatically mailed ballots to voters in precincts that are, quote, 50 voters or under, without a nearby polling location. Svoboda says that doesn't hold up to scrutiny, calling HEAP's argument nonsensical and a non sequitur. Since 2020, she pointed out, Maricopa County has used voting centers to conduct elections. There are no 50 voters or under precincts anymore. The law has also changed since then. They're just throwing things at the wall now to find some plausible reason why they're so far outside the law, she said. If HEAP persists with the plan, and if his own party takes him to court over it, it will be a dramatic escalation of an intra-party fight that has reached a boil at surprising speed. You'd think the Arizona Democratic Party would gleefully watch it play out with a bucket of popcorn, but its own internal drama is also leaking into public view. But Swoboda pointed out a sure way to lower the temperature. I have no idea why he can't just say, "I made a mistake," Swoboda said. I'm boggled. At least so far, that's not something Heap appears able to do. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on May 5th. Arizona billboards troll Elon Musk over cuts to Saguaro National Park. It's all about the fine print. Starting this month, billboards posted along highways in Phoenix and Tucson beckon travelers to visit Arizona's Saguaro National Park this summer. "Greetings from Saguaro National Park," they read, but with a caveat. "Reduced visiting hours," they say, with an asterisk at the end. Just below, "Made possible by DOGE." That would be the Department of Government Efficiency, the pseudo-agency of billionaire Elon Musk that has been slashing and burning across the federal government. The county's national, or rather the country's national parks, haven't been immune, as the billboards hope to highlight. Before Donald Trump took office in January, Saguaro National Park's two visitor centers were open 7 days a week. But in March, thanks to cuts made by DOGE, the park scaled back its hours and closed every Monday. The billboards were paid for by the progressive organization More Perfect Union, which wants to raise awareness about Trump's and Musk's effect on national parks. Billboards are a popular trolling technique, as Canada showed earlier this year. The purpose of the billboard is to put a name and a villain to the content and degradation of experience that people are feeling, said Faiz Shakir, the organization's founder. There was somebody who decided on this. In February, as a result of sweeping federal funding cuts, about 1,000 National Park Service workers were fired, or as Shakir puts it, hacked and chainsawed out of the federal government for no good reason. Additionally, the Trump administration's proposed budget would cut more than $1.2 billion from the service and would cede control of some smaller parks to the states. These cuts mean visitors face longer wait times to get into parks and fewer safety measures to protect against heat illness and other dangers. Parks have more trash and dirtier bathrooms. Cuts to the national park system set the stage for the ultimate privatization of these lands, Shakir said, which is, quote, "a grave concern to us." More Perfect Union has paid for 6 billboards in Phoenix and 4 in Tucson. Nationwide, the organization has placed 300 billboards across every major region of the country, including near Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee, and Cuyahoga National Park in Ohio. Billboards highlight issues specific to the parks that they reference, such as rising deaths, shut down campgrounds, reduced staff, or an increased level of trash or danger. Arizona's two other national parks, Grand Canyon National Park and Petrified Forest National Park, have also been impacted by the cuts. More Perfect Union plans to roll out billboards about the former later this year. Shakir said that his organization's warning about threats to the parks is a nonpartisan one that crosses ideological spectrums. Members of both parties can get on board with protecting national parks, which is why Shakir thinks the battle is a winnable one. There is a chance that you could reverse the tide and change the direction of some of these cuts if we mobilize, he said. We've got to keep up the pressure. Are the Diamondbacks spending what they're supposed to on Chase Field? This next story was written by Zach Buchanan and posted on May 8th. The Arizona Diamondbacks want public money to pay for expensive upgrades to Chase Field, and they're making big promises in order to secure it. Debuting along with the team in 1998, Chase Field is the only stadium the team has ever known. Owned by Maricopa County and built with $238 million in taxpayer dollars, the retractable roof stadium was once the pro sports jewel of the valley. But as the stadium has aged, much of the last decade has been defined by ongoing squabbles between the team and county, or tenant and landlord, over whose job it is to fix it up. The team has floated the idea of seeking a new stadium elsewhere in the valley, or even leaving Arizona altogether. But now, it's pledging to spend $250 million to upgrade the stadium, after having already spent nearly as much sprucing it up over the years, the team says. If the Arizona legislature passes a bill to spend more tax dollars on stadium improvements. If passed, the bill would set aside tax revenue already being paid. As the bill is currently constituted, state sales tax collected from purchases at the stadium, a portion of the county's excise tax, and the state income tax of team employees for the purpose of massive stadium upgrades. It's hardly a no-doubter off the bat, as both the city of Phoenix and the county have registered concerns about diverting tax revenue that's currently spent on other services. But key stakeholders met last week to hash out some of the differences, and Governor Katie Hobbs has already signaled tentative support for signing it. Key to the bill is an unenforceable portion at its bottom. Under its legislative findings section, the proposed law says the Diamondbacks will contribute at least $250 million of the professional baseball franchise's own monies to the upgrade of the 27-year-old stadium. But that big, shiny number is one the public can only take on faith. The legislature cannot compel the team to spend its own money, but only put in writing that the team has promised to do so. So, as lawmakers attempt to push the bill over the finish line, there's a question worth asking. How good are the Diamondbacks at keeping their promises? Missing payments? To answer that question requires examining the team's current agreement to use the ballpark. In 2018, to settle a lawsuit brought by the team over stadium repair costs, the team and the county struck a Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, that gave the Diamondbacks more control over the stadium. Included in the agreement was a trade-off. The team would take over responsibility for repairs in exchange for the right to book concerts and other non-baseball events at the ballpark. The profits from those events, some $2 million a year, would be put into a Chase Field reserve account for the explicit purpose of stadium fixes. Crucially, the MOU gives the team sole control over the reserve account and does not allow the county, and therefore the public, to see what goes into it. The only glimpse into how the Diamondbacks are using the money comes from quarterly stadium repair expense reports the team submits to the Maricopa County Stadium District, whose Board of Governors is composed of the five county supervisors. Through a public records request, Phoenix New Times has obtained all of those reports. For the last 4 years, those reports have included a balance of the reserve account. The reports reveal a few interesting things. One is that the team has indeed spent regularly on stadium repairs, which the MOU says must fall under four categories of qualifying work. Essentially, safety repairs, plumbing and cooling repairs, roof repairs, and repairs to the scoreboard and sound system. Since the agreement went into effect on September 2018, the Diamondbacks have spent $17.6 million of the reserve account for such fixes. Only once, when the team used reserve account money to pay for a pricey new artificial turf field, did the county object. Then County Board Chairman Bill Gates sent a letter arguing that installing the turf is not qualified work, though the team has insisted that abandoning natural gas eases the burden on other systems that the reserve count would pay to repair. The other revelation is that the team has definitely contributed to the reserve account, but not as much as the MOU would seem to demand. Since 2021, when the team began including the balance of the reserve count in its quarterly reports, the Diamondbacks have increased the account's balance, either through deposits or investment growth, by $8.5 million. Yet, considering the requirements of the MOU, that number seems a bit short. Putting $2 million a year into the account over 4 years would account for nearly all of that total. But that would mean the team cleared only $500,000 from non-baseball events since 2021. That seems unlikely given the caliber of the events the team has attracted. Elton John and Bad Bunny in 2022, Morgan Wallen and Billy Joel in 2023, Journey and Green Day last year, plus an annual college football bowl game and many other shows. What's missing from the reserve account? Diamondbacks president and CEO Derek Hall and team CFO Tom Harris say it's the $2 million a year. In an interview last week with New Times, the two team executives said the franchise has not been depositing the required yearly payment into the reserve account and is instead setting that money aside elsewhere. "What you're not seeing is correct," Hall said. "We'll take the $2 million and we have it in our own fund." He added that the team is fulfilling its duties by accounting for that commitment on its books. "It's parked," he said. Meanwhile, Harris said the county is fully aware of that arrangement. "The county knows that. This isn't any surprise," Harris said. "We've had this discussion with them several times." The language of the MOU isn't particularly ambiguous. It says that $2 million will be paid by the team into the reserve account each year. Instead, the team is keeping that money out of public view. Reached for comment on the team's practices, the county disputed the interpretation of the yearly $2 million payment and that it could be siloed elsewhere. The language of the 2018 binding MOU makes clear the team is required to deposit $2 million per year in the reserve account, said county spokesperson Jason Berry. The county has communicated that all requirements of the MOU remain. Maricopa County remains committed to finding a long-term solution to keeping the Diamondbacks at Chase Field. New revenue stream? "What the team isn't doing," Hall insisted, "is spending any of that money on anything other than stadium work." The alternative appeared to be the case in January when the team introduced star pitcher Corbin Burnes, whom the Diamondbacks signed for 6 years and $210 million. Asked that day about running a record payroll, especially given the team's lack of a regional TV deal, team owner Ken Kendrick listed off a variety of new revenue streams that the team now enjoys. The team makes money off a jersey patch ad and a sports book that opened at the stadium, Kendrick told reporters. Then he mentioned all the concert revenues. "You guys are sensitive to the concerts and what they used to be. You'll recall I do. For 20 years, we didn't get 1 cent from any event that played in this ballpark other than our games," Kendrick said. "Now, every event that's in this ballpark, we get a share of. It's not uber lucrative, but it's still brand new money." If the team is indeed pocketing a share of concert revenue, that would be an explicit violation of the MOU with the county. That money is meant to go only to stadium repairs, for which the team did not have to pay before the MOU was struck, and not to a new star pitcher or any other non-stadium expense. Asked if he wanted to clarify Kendrick's statement, Hall said that all net concert revenues go to the stadium, and that there are new revenue streams, but we do not consider non-baseball events as one of those. If the money added to the reserve account consists only of the team's non-baseball revenue, as Hall and Harris say, than the Diamondbacks have made and deposited $8.5 million from non-baseball events over the past 4 years. That it takes this much untangling to discern what's being done with the stadium's reserve account can be chalked up to a lack of oversight mechanisms in the MOU. The county can view what comes out of the account, but not what goes in. Nothing requires the Diamondbacks to open their books. As lawmakers attempt to craft a grand compromise to keep the team at Chase Field for decades to come, that might be a lesson. Build in some accountability processes. Hall said last week he's optimistic about working out the kinks in the proposed law. He also said that the team is amenable to such oversight. Whether the stadium is still governed by the county stadium district or by a new state entity, Hall said the team will have to show each year what we're spending, so they'll keep a running tally. They'll also have to approve what we're using it for. That would be similar to the current agreement with the county. How well are the Diamondbacks living up to that one? That's up to interpretation. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.